Intersectionality. It's a key word right now. People talk about it. How are you intersected? What identities do you have that society seems to marginalize you for and keep you on the peripheries? So we talk about gender. We talk about socioeconomic status. We talk about your language. We talk about your culture. And so we now know that when those things come together, some of the dysfunctionalities of society can affect you more. So today's community change maker is excellent at walking in these spaces. The art space, the LGBTQ space, the African Nova Scotian space, the singer space, and also the strong woman space. Today, we're talking to the fantastic Kate McDonald. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Empathize Others, the podcast. Another great episode for you, Changemaker. I'm excited about this, and I'm excited about all of them, but I'm excited about this person in particular because when we think about Renaissance, when we think about versatility, when we think about multifaceted, this is the person we're talking to today. And community is a wide, wide range. And when we talk about all of the levels that you can be engaged, today's guest engages in so many different ways. It's going to be hard to fit it into an episode, but we want to welcome Kate McDonald to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, you bring a smile to me, just, you know, the way that you push the energy. And really, it's interesting, Kate, because I was talking off camera before this and we were like, you know, this work is not the work of influencers, because I think it influences, here's the clothes I'm wearing, here's the hat I'm wearing, and that's not the work you do. And I don't want that title. I don't want, but change makers, activists, it's actually tough work, but mm-hmm. You kind of do it with a smile. I've seen you without a smile, but I appreciate that you can bring an energy still to the work. And so let's get into it. And you know, I start with almost this kind of grounding of community, right? So Let's talk about young Kate. What community are you from? And when did you know you were part of a community?
Okay. So my story is actually like a little bit, I mean, I wouldn't say it's unique, but I think we're still figuring out how to talk about the African Nova Scotian kids who are adopted transracially. So that's my beginning story.
Yes.
So I was adopted when I was 17 days old, and my family grew up, raised me on Connaught Avenue. So my neighborhood was entirely white. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd say probably like 98%. And so that was the community I was raised in, but I always kind of like knew, because I went to the North Branch Library since I was very young. That was a place where I first had conversations about Blackness, like even as a child, like even at six, right? And I saw other people that looked like me. So I knew there was another community that I was attached to. Like mm-hmm. I knew that I belonged somewhere. I just wasn't really sure how to navigate the avenues to get there. But yeah, I think, those are my beginnings with community. Those are my first kind of understandings that there are several communities within Halifax. Where does that place me? Where do I belong? Which community is mine? Yeah,
that's a nice start, because many of the guests that have been on talk about the physical community and then the emotional community, right? Mm-hmm. And when you talk North Branch Library, I smile because my sister Tracy, you know, Jones Grant was, you know, a matriarch of that library, and Craig Smith and Marcus James and, you know, Terry Simons was there at a certain point. And so the North Branch Library to me was also a place for me as a kid growing up in Halifax, where I was not only introduced to literacy, because my love for books really does kind of come from seeing the stacks, you know, and the variety and choice. You could read a magazine, you could, you know, and you could find a little nook that you could, you know, and even as a young kid, I really enjoyed that. But then, you know, Connaught Avenue, as we know, if you're from Halifax, is more towards the West End. So that's your physical community, but you're drawn to this feeling of comfort, you know. And so then as you are, you know, getting older and starting to get consciousness of who you are, and maybe let's say you're more mobile too, right? Like you're a teenager, you can take a bus.
Totally.
Are you still in Halifax at this time?
Yeah. So I had the interesting experience of starting high school at QE and finishing at Citadel. So that was actually kind of cool. There were some rough moments, you know, amalgamating two schools that never really wanted to be together. I think was rivals. Really interesting. Yeah, rivals, truly, like sports rivals. Like you had heavy hitters in every avenue of sports go to both schools and rival each other forever. And it was like familial ties, right? Like you had like families like, no, my family goes to St. Pat's. No, my family goes to QE. So it was interesting to be at Citadel for those first few years. But I think that's when I really understood like the advocacy piece of being, regardless of what my postal code was, regardless of what my address was, I'm connected to all these other African Nova Scotian youth that look like me. And I found out really young, I think, that if you can speak for up and you can call people out, that's what you are, like part of your purpose. That's what you're supposed to do. So I found that voice pretty young. And I think also African Canadian studies and African Canadian literature as courses helped give me references to things that I was already feeling and things that I was trying to formulate into sentences as experiences, like someone had already written about, and now I'm going to a class that I can talk about it. So I think that was really kind of like formative for me in how to talk about things.
I have to come in here though, Kate, and I usually don't do, but the intersection of that is that I wrote the African Heritage Literature 12 course. Yeah. And so by you saying that in 2021, you just made my heart explode, right? You know, because myself and Wade Smith and Steve Hart in 1998 started writing that course for exactly the outcome that you just talked about, right? So to say that you went to Citadel, and I know Mr. Adams is my guy, and both. And so to say that lit a fire in you, so not to cut you off. But let's go back to Citadel. But that was a course that we designed for that purpose. So that's thank you for that.
If we want to do another small throwback, Tracy Jones, your sibling, was like my idol when I went to the North Branch. Just my idol. Like I looked at her like, you are the most fabulous woman I have ever seen. Talk to me. I didn't want to leave her side. I was probably a weird child. Like I didn't want to leave her alone. Because I just thought she was so cool. And I didn't
know. She ran that library.
Yes. And she gave me a small pin when I was a child that I still have. And it was like a West African shield. Anyways. Yeah. So there are a lot
to Citadel now. You're finding yourself. And there's some other issues. We're going to circle back to identity because you're finding yourself on all kinds of levels. But so advocacy, when you talk about that, because that's a key in community work, how did you work through the tension of calling out truth, talking truth to power, and often the resistance that you found? Were you okay with that from the beginning? Or did you start to get used to it after maybe being affected by that? Because you're very good with it now. How were you when you were in high school?
Had a little bit more of a temper on me than I have now when I was in high school. But also, so there was that. But also, I think I didn't really know what I was saying was controversial. Like, I didn't get it. I didn't understand. Like, there would be teachers that would be like, you know, go talk to your peers about their dress code. And I was like, in what world is that my job? Like, in what world would that ever be my responsibility? Like, what makes you think that I care about the way somebody else is dressed? And teachers will be like, okay, never mind. Never mind. So I think, I have a tendency to just say things and not really realize that they're, I don't know, outside of the box or pushing a boundary. I'm just speaking. And how you choose to interpret that. I just kind of got used to the shocked faces. And then as I got older, you know, like speaking that truth to politicians, it's like, I know you're going to be shocked. So I'm already prepared.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's okay if you're shocked. I mean, and we talk about Tracy and we talk about, you know, I think my mom is Joan Jones is a piece of that too. I find from a young age, we intersect there too, Kate, because that someone is offended. The truth can often offend somebody. So I often say, like, if you tell someone that they have bad breath, they may be offended by that, but they still have bad breath. So that's just the way it is. So now there's another piece of you that I want to delve into that you kind of, this is the true intersection. So how did art bubble up in your life? Like seeing, not only enjoying art, but and let's start with enjoying art because then you use it as a tool. But when did you know that you were an artist?
I cried when I was a child in church because I wanted to sing in the choir, but you had to be able to read, right? And I was like 4 years old. I couldn't read. So that's when I knew that like art or artistic expression was important to my life. And then I sang all my days and was in theater as soon as I could learn a line. And I think part of that was a little bit of escapism. Part of it was that we could create a new world that I could live in with different rules and less boundaries. Nice. I didn't have to follow this prescribed idea that folks had of me. The wilder, the better, the more grandiose, the more impressive. And that kind of playing with reality and the elasticity of reality was really interesting to me.
That's cool. That's cool. Because as we go through now, you go to do performing arts or performance art or performance acting at Ryerson. And I want to ask you two things about that. Because one is the experience of Ryerson. And then we need to talk about the name change, right? Yeah. So, right, because that's timely. But at this point, when you're going to the big city now, what were some of the good things about it? What were some of the bad things about it or things you had to get used to? And then is there another sense of community that you started to gather while you were in Toronto?
Beautiful. So Toronto was great because nobody looked at me. No one cared about me. Like there are millions of people. No one's bothered with what I'm doing. And that was what I was looking for. I needed like this anonymity to kind of play and experiment and express without, you know, running into my aunt's friend at the grocery store or seeing my childhood friend at the club. Like I just needed to go be a person by myself.
Yes.
And that was really great. Ryerson, how was it? I often say I would never do it again, but I'm grateful for the lessons that it taught me. And as I get older, I start to examine a little bit more of that like experience that I had at Ryerson. I'm like, I think it could have been more closely examined. I think it could have been better and healthier and more holistic. I think it could have been more loving and culturally competent, which I think segues perfectly into like change the name. Change the name.
And for the viewers, we want to contextualize that because now there's a definite conversation around residential schools. Ryerson, who the school is named after, was the creator of the residential school system for the Canadian government. And so it's interesting that you say that it had a feel. And I know from doing university work that Ryerson also has a reputation of being very diverse. But yet there's still that colonial piece that you felt. And how can they get away from the colonial piece when the school's named Ryerson?
Right. And like, I just think we understand that schooling as an institution, especially elementary and high school and junior high, like those like necessary pieces that we've like really force kids to go through. We know that there are areas of opportunity in those learning spaces. But oftentimes I feel like we don't think how post-secondary could be restructured. Truth is, it could be restructured entirely. Like it doesn't have to function like this at all. So I think, there's room for examination there for sure.
So if you even, so let's go just to the curricular piece. So yeah. In performance acting, were there things that you got out of it that you, whether you use it today or, because I know we're going to talk about some of your projects, how much of your present day projects was based on the curriculum or some of the strategies or some of the techniques that you learned at the performance acting school? Was there any of that that you could take?
Yeah. I mean, what I really, think I lean on now is we had to spend a lot of time with our bodies, right? So like learning anatomy and breathing and yoga and laying down and pretending you were a flower and like all of these things. But it's made me innately and keenly aware of my body in ways that I appreciate now, in ways that I think probably inform my work, and also in ways that I need to unlearn. Yeah. So I was very aware of my body always and always critiquing. And now it's like, okay, I need to unlearn that. And what gifts does that give me? Because we have to unlearn everything or relearn things all the time. So I'm not mad about it. It just gives me clues, right? So yeah, I use that relationship and that like movement. There was lots of like vocal work that I think probably I use now because I'm yelling in the streets sometimes. So it's come in handy. And also I was introduced to people from all across Canada, right? In my class, it was people from all over. And that I loved. And some of those people I'm still close with. And they taught me such beautiful lessons that shaped who I was in my early 20s and late teens. And I'm just so grateful for that. So that piece of community was there for sure. And sometimes it was like, I haven't seen anybody else in 6 months. Like, I don't want to look at y'all. Yeah. I could rely on them.
And it talks about that same thing that we had from the beginning around the physical community and emotional community, because you're in Toronto and there's an anonymity, but we still need community. And so there's this emotional space of difference and people from all over. That's, I think, the beautiful thing about the post-secondary experience. It's an elite experience, right? Definitely. Not everyone. That's not for everyone. But what it does do is bring same age people with diversity, like they're from all over, and they bring them in one spot. And whether you're in residence or you're living off campus or you're going out to have a drink or you're going out to an art show or a protest, you're going out with someone from Manitoba, someone from Brampton, someone from New Brunswick. Like, and that, our high schools don't have that. Like you said, our high schools are basically the same kids we knew since we were young, right?
Yeah.
So now there's another piece, and I know that you wear this proudly as far as the LGBTQ plus community, the queer community. And so when we talk about it's a nice, because this is going to get us into how you intersect, because you talk about African Nova Scotian and Blackness, you talk about your art piece. Can you talk about the identity or the community of the LGBTQ plus community that you proudly hail from?
Yeah, absolutely. So I really like figured out and was able to give language to myself that felt validated when I was around 15. So that's like half my life at this point. And I think in high school, you know, people would try and make those digs, but I just like couldn't be bothered, you know, as like a Black African Nova Scotian queer female identifying youth. I was like, I can't be bothered by what you have to say. Like, I have so many other things to do. But I did find, and again, like this theme that keeps coming up, which is this like, kind of like play and experiment within the queer community, because I started seeing drag queens really young. And I started engaging in conversations with people about their gender and how they felt and how they expressed themselves. So that piece of community, to be in those play spaces, to be in those creative spaces, to be in those nuanced conversations, that was really beautiful. And I've had some friends that are part of this community alongside me, and we've been friends for like 10 plus years. And that is just so beautiful. And I've watched them grow and shift and change and experiment. And it's been amazing.
No, you again, great conversation, because I think, as you say, when you have these conversations, with people who, and conversations that people trust you, you're in their circle, you're in their community, it's a totally different conversation because it's while you're sitting down, it's socializing, but you can talk about, because how people feel, obviously we know that how people identify is so diverse, right? And so by you being able to have those conversations, it almost empowers you more to be who you are and love who you love and express yourself the way you do, because you're talking to people that are also have telling you that same narrative.
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, it was just a gift that I found that community young, right? So I had folks that were a few years older than me that would introduce me to more folks and more folks and more folks, and it started to grow. And yes, I think it was so key having people kind of guide me through that experience, take me under their wing and care for me, that really like saved me from a lot of circumstances that I think could have been less than favorable. And then I think about how it would have been if I had an African Nova Scotian person come take me under their wing that was also queer. Like that would have changed my life. Like,
and that wasn't there?
No. So the queer community, it's not that it's not diverse. It's not that it's more white, but I think that there's less barriers to coming out when, or expressing your identity when you're white, right? Because you're not dealing with the added pressures of racism, yes, which is how people see you in space. They oftentimes see your race or categorize your race first. So, yes, and there's like language in our community, I think, in ways that we embrace queer and trans youth and have difficult conversations around how we care for queer and trans youth that just separate the African Nova Scotian queer and trans community a little bit from the larger queer community. I think it's changing now. I see more and more young folks taking up space and coming out to me and proudly asserting who they are and using language and exploring their gender. And that makes me so proud, but yes, it wasn't really like that for me. I was, you know, fighting to get in there.
No, and you're making a great point though, Kate, because for me working, you know, in the school system, especially at the high school level, we've identified that the GSAs, the Gay Student Alliance at schools, are mostly white. And so we're realizing that to start off, you may have to be in community for African Nova Scotian youth to feel comfortable coming out and being in that space at a library, at a community center, et cetera. Because in school, sometimes I don't think the GSAs realize how exclusive they are, right? I don't think they may not even be trying to be that. Go ahead.
No, and I've had brilliant conversations about gender and sexual orientation with African Nova Scotian community members in community. Now, is it like post-secondary feminism language? No.
Yeah.
But like, who has that language? Like, I don't even know that I have that language anymore. So it's also like the space that we can create or should be creating for people to engage in these conversations is like, let people be wrong first and worry about the language afterwards. You know, like, what's the essence of the conversation? What's the energy, the emotion behind the conversation? And when I'm in community with you, if you trip up or you just like are speaking freely and it's not perfect, well, I can tell you with love afterwards, right? But it's really more important that we're engaging in the conversation. So I think there's like a level of that piece also that's like people are scared to say the wrong thing.
Well, you hit on something that we can spread out, because the people that are watching and listening to the podcast are engaging in what does community look like and how do you stretch your boundaries. And you hit on something very, very key here, because I remember I taught in St. Lucia, they spoke Patois. And whenever I tried to speak Creole, because after being there for a while, I knew it. If I was in a space where they were criticizing every single, because there's no way I could be fluent like I grew up in St. Lucia. So the time I could speak my little bit of broken Creole was around people that allowed me to make mistakes. And I find that, so when you're going outside your comfort zone, as you speak to, that's not only in the LGBTQ plus community around, you know, we don't say that word anymore, or this is my pronoun or whatever. You have to give people a little bit of leeway when they're stepping outside into your, whether it's African Nova Scotian or Indigenous or whatever it is. You really hit on something around having patience with people, because if people are so afraid to express themselves, how can they embed themselves in diversity, go outside their comfort zone, when as soon as they say the wrong word, pa, pa, and we're making them feel bad?
Totally. And like, Yeah, I just think that there, to say that language doesn't have a certain level of like classism or exclusion, like it does. It does, because people are disenfranchised in lots of educational spaces, which means they're not getting access to the same language, right? Yes. Or if your literacy is low, then can you engage in these conversations in the same way? Like, yes, you can engage in the conversation the same way if the conversation is being held with love and care at the basis, if that's our baseline. And that's what community
And you're given that space, right? To give your first voice how you give it. Right, because you're exactly right. Everyone has a first voice, but we often don't use it when we don't feel safe in the space that we are. And I think that we do that as African Nova Scotians. We, you know, there are times when we're, and maybe it comes from trauma, but we're very protective and very sensitive around what's being done in our space. And that's something that marginalized groups also have to work on, because you want people to explore your space.
Absolutely. And the other thing that's really interesting around like gender and sexual orientation, the pioneers of this movement and the relative liberations and freedom we have now were Black people, right? Like this is our history. This is innately ours. We are the engineers of this movement. And so then to look at Black folks, and also I will say this, and I believe this, that we have a certain level of homophobia and transphobia that's projected onto Black people.
Yes.
And I don't know that that's ours to actually carry. I don't believe that. I think that those were things that we were taught, perhaps things that we can unlearn, and not ancestrally ours. So.
Yeah, there's a learned, almost a self-hate too. Like, you know, if we look at the dysfunctionality of trauma, there's a lot of that built into it. So we're gonna segue a little bit here. So you were the Grand Marshal of the Pride Parade in 2019, which is they're recognizing you as a leader in the community. So that's a beautiful piece. And so I'm now going to, because you did so many things, and I was thinking about this before the podcast, that what we're gonna do is a little word association. So I'm gonna say a project that you were involved with, and you tell me about it. And all of these are community projects. Okay. So the first one would be obviously the Magic Project.
Ah, okay. Do you want me to just like say a little blurb about it?
Yeah, and it, like what it is, and then it can be kind of like, so obviously to the viewers, what it is, and then what is its connection to community?
Oh, cool. Yeah. So the Magic Project is an art-based project that I started in 2016 when Donald Trump was elected, because I was really concerned with the messaging that would kind of flood the media. So yeah, started this project, was like, let's do a photo shoot. Photos are easy. Social media, you can put whatever you want on. So let's start with Black Girls Are Magic and see how this lands. So let's gather a bunch of Black women together and let's celebrate them through photography. And that took off. Like that project had like 24,000 views, like a blog reviewed it in LA. And I was like, I don't know what to do with this other than do another photo shoot. So then did another photo shoot, Black Kings Are Magic, then Disabilities Have Magic. So my father is blind. And I grew up my whole life like explaining, like he's perfectly capable. Like I really need folks to stop asking me what he can and cannot do. Like he does everything. I don't know how to answer this. So was also this conversation, that I've been having since I was like, could speak, of people being like, you need to reframe and reshape what your understanding of disability is, because you're projecting and it's not cute.
That's strong. That's very strong. And so a next association, and again, what is it? And its connection to community. Game Changers 902.
Oh, my brothers. So that's an initiative that I started with Derico Simons and Trayvon Clayton. And we have been like secretly meeting at the North Branch Library for almost a year. Yes, yes. Marcus James, the Connect. And so we started this initiative, and it was really like activism based. So like getting people out in the streets to have large scale conversations about police brutality and police murder of Black people here and south of the border, like borders aren't real. But it was all through the lens of African Nova Scotian first. And I think that we've started a few initiatives. We helped like raise money. We've done a few workshops. We've helped gather information. We started a pro bono program with McGinnis Cooper. We have a partnership with ECL. Again, all kind of rooted in like, how do we make or alleviate barriers for African Nova Scotian folks to things, to all things, and make sure that we're thought of along the way.
And I thought you three have done, we've had, you know, Dorico's been on the show, and you know, I think that all three of you have been this young, energizing force around what activism looks like in 2021, you know, because it's not 1971, it's not 1981. And so there are ways that I think at the time, I think about the work that my mom and dad were doing, Rocky and Joan Jones, it was innovative at the time, right? Those techniques don't necessarily work in 2021. Of course, a march is a march. That never grows old. But I think there's other ways that you guys have used that has activated and reached out to a community on the level that they want to be communicated to, especially with youth. A couple of other things to get to. The Every Seeker Festival. And you were at that festival. And so how did you find out about the festival? I know the organizers because I've worked with them at the Youth Project. But talk a little bit about that festival and what community that's in.
Well, this is like the experimental arts community, right? And Every Seeker, so it's interesting because I actually was at the table with Every Seeker for a long time, doing some consulting work, doing some brainstorming work, helping be there to rename the festival. And I also did some work with them a few years back through the Magic Project, where they have this like one event called Oh Baby. And yes. Created this kind of like based on the five senses, sensory space for kids, for babies. And the kids came and destroyed it and like just, but it was beautiful. And the parents actually thanked me afterwards because there's not a lot of spaces that kids can go and make a mess and no one's worried.
Yeah. That's revolutionary. Yeah. That's deep. Yeah, and again, that's what I appreciate about you, Kate. Like, you're multifaceted, and your mind goes into spaces. There's a freedom to your mind, and I really appreciate that, and that you're willing to go into those spaces. So now I'm going to bring you again. We're not done yet.
All right.
Overdose prevention, and being involved with that. What's your connection to that? And obviously, I think it's embedded in the North End community. But what was your connection to that?
So I struggled with addiction for years, and I really, like, honestly, by the love and grace of community, was able to see myself as someone on the other side of that. So again, community really did just like love me through that. There was no other way. There is no other way, I think, also. And so was helping facilitate these conversations between some members of the African Nova Scotian community tied closely to the church and folks who are working in harm reduction and overdose prevention. And the tension in those conversations was real and justified, but it was important conversation to have. And sometimes important conversations are messy and bring up lots of anger. But I think ultimately, how do we reduce the harm? That's all. Right? How do we make it? What do we prioritize to reduce harm in circumstances of addiction and drug usage?
Yeah, and there's a theme when you talk about your dad and his abilities, right? Mm-hmm. That's what you focus on, and you think about someone who is struggling with drug use. They have abilities. They need love too, right? And that's actually their way out. And so when we exclude them because we now shame them, we're not able to help them, right? And so I think that there's a theme around you going into spaces and opening doors and being open-minded to listen to that space, to see in ways that you can advocate and get there and be there in the community. So I really, again, I love these podcasts because I get to know my guess, I knew you before the podcast, but I know you even better now. And now there's another piece, which is for people who don't know Halifax, the downtown region used to be a Black community. And so people can look up the history of Africville, but even beyond Africville, Creighton Street, Maynard, Cornwallis, I grew up with those areas having my friends live in them. That's basically the community YMCA. Most of the people that were facilitating coaching and after school, they lived two blocks from the Y. These were adults who lived two blocks from the Y. Now the North End has changed. So I'm now going to bring you to the North End Business Association and, mm-hmm. and your work with them, because gentrification comes up, right? Those, because the value of those houses went down, a different culture of people moved in to that community. There's not a lot of mm-hmm. Black people living in that community anymore, except for the what we might call the housing project, which is Uniac Square. So talk about your work with the North End Business Association and how it was linked to your community advocacy.
Right. So the North End Business Association puts on like a festival every summer, or I guess like, yeah, every summer. COVID kind of obviously messed with that flow. But and there used to be a festival called the Uptown Festival.
Yeah,
and so,
I remember, yeah.
Yeah. So I talked to some people and I tried to bring that back when I was working there. So I was just on a term. And I featured predominantly African Nova Scotian racialized performers in that festival intentionally, because I want to reclaim a little bit of space. At the same time, that evening, I helped coordinate an art show that was happening at Alter Ego's, also an African Nova Scotian artist. The after party across the street at Men's and Molly's also had an African yes. Nova Scotian DJ. So again, trying to put this African Nova Scotian lens first. It's also my lived experience, so it's what I know, but it felt like a way to reclaim some space in these markets and festivals that don't often honor how yes. much African Nova Scotian people have contributed in at large.
Well, yeah, and there's also almost like this this memory stick that you have to beat people with, so that we know, like I know Gottesian Street was a Black owned business street. I remember my mom, right? I would be dropped off at the library and she shopped for groceries across the street. There was mm-hmm. the Met, which was the Walmart of the 1970s, was on that street. The best movie theater in the city, actually two of them, the Casino and the Cove, were on that street. Mm-hmm. The Misty Moon was on that street. Like that mm-hmm. street was so comfortable for Black people. I didn't even mention the Derby. The Derby was on that street. And so yes. when you bring back those spaces, it's almost to let the people that live there now, who rightly so, if you buy a house and you live in that neighborhood, all good. You paid the money, it's all good. You don't need to know, maybe you don't know the history. That's great. But for you then to not be comfortable with Black people is my issue, right? Because absolutely. That is an area that was traditionally. So by you bringing those spaces, Kate, you're allowing mm-hmm. people to deal with this kind of forgotten history of what the community used to be.
Absolutely. And for that festival, we also hired an African Nova Scotian graphic designer. So it was really beautiful and intentional and on purpose. And I remember even like in the 90s being on Gottesian and just how Black it was and yeah. how beautiful that was and how Black the library was. And there were people who had positions of power and they were Black. And yes. yeah, I don't, again, this memory stick that you speak of, I don't want anybody to forget. I don't want anyone to ever forget the contributions that our communities across the entire province have made. And we should be coming for a lot more, right?
Yes.
Like we should, if we came for everything we were owed, the province wouldn't have anything left, which I think is a really interesting conversation, you know?
Yeah.
Like yeah. there was a lot of free labor. There was a lot of underpaid labor, under-celebrated work. Beginnings that started with us, language, culture, music, expression, community. We do community really good. And yeah, of course, you know, communities like family And we're both in the African Nova Scotian community. We are literally family and community. And there are some, yes, just some things that we do that are absolutely golden. And,
and a collective community mind too, Kate, is survival, right? Because when you're in a situation we never had, I don't know a lot of families that had the affluence to be able to move to a space where they put fences around and they weren't connected to their neighbor. But like when you grow up close, and many of the people that have been on the podcast talked about this, sometimes community is forced upon you, right? Like you're so close to people that you have to get to know them. And so, but there's a beauty in that, right? There's that silver lining is that I can honestly, every day of my life, Kate, I cannot think individually. When I go to work, I bring community with me to every meeting. Everything I do is community. My parents embedded community in me. I only know community. It's interesting that you say that it's something that we celebrate. Sometimes people call that Afrocentricity, right? That whole thing of it takes a village, but not everybody thinks that way. And so I'm glad you brought that up as we're closing out this episode, because that's what community means to me. And community exists outside the Black community. There's all kinds of communities, and you flex in many different communities, right? Mm-hmm. But it is the safety net around that word, right? That collective safety net. What do you think of that?
The collective safety net around the word community?
Yeah, like in the feeling.
Oh, I mean, so there's two pieces of it, because it's hard to balance, because you don't want to people please, right? Like I still need to do what I need to do, what I know is right, and trust it. But also that piece that community will still love you even when you make a mistake, right? And community will really, what I really learned was if community don't like what you did, they'll tell you. And it's not to come for you. It's not to bring you down, right? But it's to say, I love you enough to see an error in your ways. And if I didn't love you, I wouldn't tell you.
Yes. And if I did, and not I have the right to say something to you, I have the right to talk to you. I'm not afraid of you. So, and I know you're not going to, even if you do take a personal work community, but there's a beauty mm-hmm. in that.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's interesting you bring up the like fences, because I grew up with fences, right? Like I grew up with space, like people, but that's just how I was raised. We just had space. Like if you ever are on Connaught Avenue, you'll see the houses got fences in the backyard. And you keep a certain level of distance from people. But even though I grew up in that space, I've had community members tell me that they kept an eye on me. They knew where I was, right? Specifically, Leslie State said this to me the other day. Like, I saw you play basketball and I always kept my eye on you. And I never lost track of you. And then I did for a couple of years, but I saw you again. You gave me the biggest hug and like just... it's so emotional for me because I did feel alone so often, you know, like being one of the only Black people in that neighborhood. But to know that I was loved, to be watched over, it's like, whoa, I was surrounded by angels. Like my life has been so blessed to be a part of this community, to be loved by this community, to be able to do any work, to be trusted to do any work is really like a blessing to me. So yeah, I try and do right by y'all.
Listen, you are, and you don't have to be right by me. Keep doing what you're doing, Kate. Listen, that's a great way to end off. And I want to thank you for everything that you do. Keep doing what you do. You bring a beautiful energy to community work, to diversity, to inclusion, to intersectionality. And so, you know, I'm proud of the things you do. Keep doing what you're doing. And I'm a supporter. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. And likewise, much respect, so much gratitude to the work you've done that's impacted my life exponentially, and lots of love and praise to your family, to Tracy, to Rocky, to Joan. I truly stand on their shoulders.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Empathize Others, the podcast. We hope you truly enjoyed the show. Now, if you're enjoying the podcast series as a whole, as much as we're enjoying making it, please let us know by subscribing and leaving us a 5-star rating. When you subscribe, you'll know right away when our new episodes are released. Did you know you can also watch the video version of this episode on our own YouTube channel?
Just search YouTube for Empathize Others, and it will bring you to all of our episodes. We hope to see you there too. If you'd like to learn more about Empathize Others overall, please visit our website at www.empathizeothers.com. Follow us on Twitter at Empathize Others, or link us on Instagram at Empathize_Others. Thanks again for listening to this episode. I'm Augie Jones.